From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from Eskenazi Health. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, we feature a concert for adults, another for kids, and some Vietnamese soup. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. This week, we take a trip through sound. We'll meet the South American version of an accordion and learn about the healing powers of Vietnamese soup. But first, the IMA's Senior Conservation Specialist Gregory Smith and his colleague, Curatorial Assistant Anna Stein, have been conducting a sleuthing project to learn how we can walk into an art supply store and purchase paint in any color of the rainbow in convenient packages.
Well, Chemistry of Color is actually the third in a series of exhibitions that we've been doing at the museum. We call these the CSI series, which for us stands for Conservation Science Indianapolis. So these are a series of exhibitions which focus on the interaction of art and science.
And not unlike the CSI on television that's referenced, there's a forensic aspect.
Of course. In our field, we deal all the time with things like evidence and clues, mystery and discovery. So we've used that as a way to draw people in to talk about some of the work that happens behind the scenes at the museum.
And your background is in conservation. What led you to that?
I'm trained as a chemist, an analytical chemist, but early on, pure science wasn't doing it for me, and so I also started to explore areas of culture and art, in particular in archaeology. So my background is split between chemistry and archaeology, and then that ultimately led to a career in museums using science to analyze artwork.
Wow. And Anna, your background is in more traditional curatorial skills, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have multiple art history degrees,
yeah,
and ended up on the track of art history after dropping out of chemistry in high school. So I was brought back.
That'll teach you.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're actually good colleagues for one another because you can say, so why does it work this way,
yeah,
right?
And there was a lot of question asking on my part and the part of the additional curator of the exhibition, Annette Schlagenhoff. We both often went, we sort of get this, Greg, but you're going to have to explain the technical side to us.
Well, you're kind of standing in for the general public who's coming in maybe with great background in appreciating art but not understanding, well, how does it get that way?
I think absolutely that would – I would agree with that statement. All our conversations went that way.
So when you can walk into a store, buy some oil paint from an online store today and, you know, take it out of the tube and put it on your palette and mix it and start using it, and it's super easy, and it hasn't always been that way.
Well, certainly the paint tube. So before that, you would have made your paints yourself, and that would involve sourcing some form of color, and that's, of course, the subject of the whole exhibition is where do we get color from? And then that would be prepared in a binding medium, oil for oil paint or gum arabic for watercolor. So the idea of being able to just walk into a shop and pick up a tube of paint is, yes, something relatively recent.
And if those 19th century painters could get in the time machine and come talk to contemporary painters, they'd be so envious.
They would be amazed at the range of colors that are available. And so one of the things that in planning out this exhibition that kept coming up is how we're just surrounded by color and we take it for granted. But of course, it hasn't always been that way. And it's that desire for color that really drew in scientists early on from the demands of art and fashion and decorating to invent new routes to bright, relatively inexpensive color. And so that's one of the themes of the exhibition, is this push-pull between art and science, that it's the demands of art which actually led to the birth of synthetic organic chemistry. So as an undergraduate chemistry major, I was learning about these scientists, names like Bayer and Hoffman and Cairo, and I just assumed that they were making plastics or drugs or pharmaceuticals, things like that. But in fact, all of these early chemists were employed by dye works, and so their job was to try and invent the next bright color, and that would be something that they would patent and sell.
So the sources for colors are wildly disparate, aren't they? I mean, for the original the dye or the original medium, and it might be a plant, it might be a mineral.
It could be a mineral, a rock. It could be something that's extracted from a plant. Part of the interest of the exhibition is to see this diversity. So it might be the juice of a bug. A lot of people don't think of us of getting color from animals.
What kind of colors do we get from bugs?
Well, one of the colors that we deal with in the exhibition is called carmine. It comes from the cochineal insect, and so it's extracted out of that bug and then is used to dye carpets. It can be made into an artist pigment for oil painting, for making those beautiful red translucent glazes that artists would use.
And it's still used in things today. One of the activities in the exhibition actually is something that prompts you to find the bug-based dyes in a couple different everyday products that we still eat or put on our faces.
Wow. I have this fear that somebody's listening to this conversation with a 5-year-old in the back seat who can't wait to get out of the car to go smash something and see if he can extract color from it. Please don't do that.
Absolutely.
But, you know, that is how we discover these things, trial and error, and I wonder what's inside there or how. Because lots of times the sources for the original material of the color aren't the color. They, you know, that insect is not the color that
right. It's
you
a
extract.
Compound that is made by the insect.
Right.
And so we've also talked about, you know, who thought to do this. So
right.
If you go back to 3500 BC, when the Egyptians discovered Egyptian blue, named after them.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody figured out that mixing sand and natron, the embalming salts, with chalk and a source of copper, it would go in green-colored into a furnace, and this would then be cooked in a furnace, and it would come out this brilliant blue glassy frit that would be ground up and used as a pigment. And it has amazing longevity. If you see Egyptian tombs and sarcophagi, all those blues are made of this compound Egyptian blue. But who thought to do that very early chemistry?
Right. And in many cases, it might have been an accident, a happy accident, but an accident.
Serendipity, absolutely.
So what is one of the strangest facts you've learned? I'm looking at Anna because she said, well, okay, I was told there'd be no chemistry in this field, right?
I know. I was duped and deceived. Well, even though chemistry has been a very important aspect of this exhibition, I still am the person who clings to sort of the historical fun facts.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a yellow in the exhibition that has its source has been debated by scientists and historians,
mm-hmm.
but the leading story of how this yellow came about is that it was extracted from cow urine.
Really?
Cows that were fed exclusively mango leaves. And some people have said, well, we haven't found the proper historical source for this. Recently, Greg has read some research by scientists who think they've proven that it really might be from cow urine. But, you know, of all things, I guess we're kind of, you know, first we had dead bugs, now we've got cow urine. There's some interesting kind of funky animal-based sources for these pigments.
So, Greg, I'm looking at you because this is your field. You live and breathe this stuff every day. Did anything in preparing this third iteration for CSI surprise you or make you go, whoa?
Well, I think for me, this exhibition was really the opportunity to tell some very familiar stories from my career, familiar to me, but of course not familiar to the general public. And so it was a real opportunity to share some of these amazing discoveries, to try to combat this notion that there are people with an arts mind and people with a science mind,
right,
and never the two shall meet, that in fact there's this incredibly rich interface that exists between art and science and always has.
The IMA's Senior Conservation Specialist Gregory Smith and his colleague, Curatorial Assistant Anna Stein. They were talking about the IMA's CSI, Conservation Science Indianapolis, exhibit called The Chemistry of Color. The exhibit explores the relationship between chemistry and art by discussing the discovery of colorants used by artists from prehistory to the present day through relevant examples from the IMA collection. And you can see it through December 7th of this year. Winter's Day is a great time to warm up with some tango music. Indy's Pro Arte Chamber Orchestra is bringing in internationally renowned bandoneon player Pietro Suave for their February 19th concert, and I invited music director Stan DeRuscia to tell me about the instrument and the concert called Tangos in Indy.
For somebody who's never seen or heard a bandoneon, can you describe it for us?
Well, it's a strange-looking instrument in a sense. It looks like an elongated box. And it has bellows in the middle of it and two keyboards on either end. I mean, not dissimilar to the accordion, except that it opens up to probably a meter, almost a meter and a half. So the player almost can't get far enough away from each other before they can come back.
So you have to have long arms to be a player, is what
you're
saying.
I think so. Even better extensions. I don't know. And it's very complex. I've never quite understood it. Peter's tried to explain it to me a couple of times, but it has no logic to it. It isn't in fifths, it isn't in fourths. There's no scalic kind of combinations. I don't know how they ever learned to play the instrument, but it's a terrific instrument.
And unlike maybe somebody who took piano accordion, American accordion lessons as a child, it's different because it's a different note on the push and the pull, right?
That's right. You
that
can't
sounds
depend
crazy.
On sustaining a note if you're doing the same motion all in a different direction. It doesn't work.
In the United States, there's kind of this clear division between popular music and classical music.
Yeah.
The repertoire for this concert in particular, and for that matter for most of the Pro Arte concerts, kind of mixes that up. There's not such a clear-cut line, right?
Yeah, I don't think there is. There's certainly probably more esoteric music that we could play and still call it Latino. But the divide is not as clear as it is in the United States. And I think that's kind of attractive. I think it allows all kinds of people to enjoy various styles without having to put their foot in one pot or the other.
With the musicians that you have as part of the chamber orchestra, these are what's the sports term? They're utility players. They can and do play in lots of different orchestras, and a lot of them play jazz as well. Do you ever have to do anything special in preparing them? I mean, do you ever have to kind of say, okay, imagine yourself dancing so that they can kind of internalize?
That's a very good analogy. That's the best for how. But when you watch tango dancers dance, you get very scared because they look dangerous, but they don't have to be. Yes, I think the other, of course, is just to kind of let yourself get into the feel of the music because, you know, like much other music, it's the style of the tango that you know, is irresistible. It's not so much the melodies, although there's beautiful melodies, particularly Piazzolla, but it's the style of the music that has to be there up front and easily distinguishable.
And tell us about Peter Suave, who you've brought him to town before with Pro Arte,
yeah.
But it's been a few
yes.
years.
Yeah, this is the third time that we've brought him. And about 6-7 years ago, he and his wife, Mari, moved to her family's farmhouse outside of Lyon in France. So all of his surroundings have changed greatly. And so he's been traveling throughout Europe playing with some great orchestras and some wonderful chamber music. Opportunities, and he's having just a wonderful time. But he comes back at least once a year to make some of his rounds where people want him to play with them. So we're kind of catching on to that this year.
Because there can't be that many bandoneon soloists easily accessible, right?
Easily accessible. That's a good question. You might be surprised. Of course, in South America, particularly in Uruguay and Argentina, it's like a dime a dozen. You can't believe how many bandoneon players you can find. But it's a rare instrument. It's not something that people are walking the streets playing, at least yet, in the United States.
Well, maybe you'll be a part of changing that.
Ooh, that's a great idea. It's a very attractive instrument.
Stan DeRuscia is founder and music director of the Pro Arte Chamber Orchestra. The Tangos in Indy concert is Sunday, February 19th at 7 in the evening at Indiana Landmark Center. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, and I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, a Vietnamese soup celebration. But first, Black Metal Barbecue is a mobile business focused on the twin arts of barbecue and community building. Jolene Ketzenberger recently chatted with owner Chris Morrison for Eat Drink Indy.
Black Metal Barbecue. Tell me how it all started.
Okay. Black Metal Barbecue basically started when I became obsessed with barbecue. I say I'm obsessed and possessed because of the black metal thing. I started probably barbecuing back, you know, early 2000s in my backyard when we got our new house, and trying to replicate, you know, some of the ribs I had at restaurants or things like that, you know, failing sometimes, you know, nailing it a little bit, I guess. And then I kept doing it, practicing, and we'd have people over for cookouts, and next thing I know, I didn't even get to taste my ribs. They were all gone. I did that for a while in the backyard, just grilling like on a gas grill, trying to make it work with like wood chips on the side like I read on the internet. But I kept doing that. And then eventually I got my own backyard pit, which was a Weber Smoky Mountain. Became obsessed with the barbecue books, the barbecue TV shows, things like that. And then I joined the barbecuebrethren.com forum online, which if anybody's looking for barbecue information, that's the site to go to. It's fantastic. And I would read that forum every day, use the search function, and just find answers to anything I needed to try to make my food better. So, yeah.
So you were kind of obsessed.
I was, and it's only grown from there. I am absolutely obsessed with barbecue.
So now tell me a little bit about the name and what your plans are for the business now, right?
Yeah, okay. Black Metal Barbecue. The name comes from basically my love for metal music, and you know, like I grew up playing metal and punk rock and hardcore and stuff like that. And then it's kind of the antithesis of, you know, the barbecue kitsch and like the funny little pigs, you know, with like their little outfits and like the corny names, which is awesome. Yeah. Like you go to barbecue competitions and everybody has like these names that are full of puns and it's hilarious. But I kind of wanted to be a little bit different, but we don't take ourselves seriously. I mean, if you look at our logo, it's cheesy in its own way, which we did that on purpose. But it just shows who we are. You know, we're not country boys or anything like that. We were from the city. We like metal music. You know, that we got to be who we are. That's not us. So yeah, I mean, that's where the Black Metal Barbecue comes from. And you know, right now we have an Indiegogo campaign going. We're taking the business to the next level.
Well, now tell me about that. Tell me how you decided to pursue that kind of funding.
Okay. Well, we raised I saved up and I got some family help and scraped together every penny from all the pop-up gigs, catering gigs we did. And we were able to purchase a trailer. But, so we had most of the funding ready for that. You know, we bought the big parts. We have the smoker. We have the trailer. You know, and so we decided, you know, to start a little crowdfund campaign and give back to some people. We have some awesome perks, you know, that parties that are cheap, you know, 15 people for $300. I mean, it's not a bad deal. Plus, you get to give to a good business. So we're doing that to be able to outfit the trailer with a few things that we still need and to pay for our insurance and things like that to get us rolling without debt, because so far we've been able to do this without going into debt, which is great for us because it makes it a pretty low risk, you know, proposition. So that's where we are now.
So now tell me about the catering part of it. That seems like that kind of snowballed as well.
Yes, you know, the catering part's actually my favorite part of it. We love to take our barbecue to, you know, events and to parties and have people come around the pit, hang out with us, you know, if we do the on-site catering. It's super fun. Everybody comes around and just wants to know about what we're doing, wants to know about the pit, wants to know about what wood we're using, wants to know how long we cook our brisket. They want to know all that stuff, which is perfectly fine because I want to teach people. You know, I want people to, you know, love barbecue as much as I do, you know. And the catering is also, we're going to be licensed as a food truck, but the catering hopefully will get us through the colder months and will add to, you know, the end profit and all that, so.
So it's a very sociable scene, barbecue is, don't you think?
Absolutely, and that's one of my favorite things about it, the community aspect, and that's something that I hope to help bring to Indy. I mean, there's some great barbecue restaurants, there's great barbecue people around Indianapolis, but I want to help tie it all together somehow, and I want Black Metal Barbecue to be known as like a place where people want to go spend their Saturday afternoon, hang out around the trailer, or eventually, you know, a small restaurant barbecue shack, you know, drinking beers, hanging out, you know, playing games, whatever, just grabbing a tray of food with a bunch of friends and hanging out. So, you know, from the response we've had before at our events, you know, the vibe that I want has been there. So I see no reason why we can't, you know, make this happen and bring awesome barbecue to Indy, you know, in addition to what's already here, and bring our, you know, heavy metal party attitude to the scene as well. You know, I really think it can happen. You know, people want it. The response is there. People love barbecue. People love to have fun. That's all we want to do is have fun and serve people awesome barbecue.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Yelp India is celebrating Vietnamese cuisine in Indianapolis during the month of February, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here to tell us more.
Cold weather, Sharon, that means we need to warm our bellies, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I sat down with Yelp Indy's marketing diva, Brittany Smith, and also with Tina Lee from Saigon Restaurant to find out just what Yelp Indy is cooking up. Brittany, you always have to have a catchy name for one of your Yelp months. Give us the name for February.
Yes, it's February, and I give credit to my sister for this one. So a month-long celebration of pho and Vietnamese cuisine.
All right, and when we're talking about pho, we're talking about that. It's P-H-O.
Yes.
What is pho?
Oh my gosh, asking me, and I feel like I have Tina, the expert, beside me, but I would describe it as a steamy broth that has so many great ingredients in it. It's usually a bone broth. It's very refreshing. It's great when you're sick or you just need some healing powers, filled with rice noodles. You have jalapeno, basil, all these great flavors packed into one bowl.
How did she do, Tina?
She did great, yeah.
Great.
You have some ingredients you could add.
Yeah, okay. Tell us about the pho that you create at Saigon.
The pho that we create at Saigon is mostly what Brittany said. Our broth is created for about 24 hours, so our bones are created with the beef bones. And then after that, we put lots of different spices in there, and that creates the flavors. And then after that, we put in rice noodles, we dip different types of beef, then we can do even chicken and also, and then different vegetables like basil, jalapenos, bean sprouts.
All different kinds of things. Yeah. So it's pho brewery. So obviously one of your events must be celebrating this elixir.
And it's with Tina at Saigon. So she's going to be showing us how the broth is actually made. That's like the key thing with pho that people are so curious about is the broth, because it's not something you're going to run home and make on your own. It takes a lot of effort. And Saigon definitely has a down pat. They've been making it for years, so they know their stuff.
And this is your family's restaurant. Does each family have their own recipe for pho, or is there kind of one generic recipe?
I would say that each family have their own recipe. I think there's like a lot of basics with it. just mostly a lot of the same with, like, American recipes, a lot of, like, traditional basics that come into it, but then there's also, like, a twist that comes with your recipes as well. So we put our own twist onto our recipes that makes it a little bit different than other recipes around.
How is Vietnamese cuisine different than other Asian cuisines?
A lot of other Asian cuisines are, like, more stir fries or more, like, oil-based and more salt-based, which is ours is more like fish sauce, and that's how we get our salty. That's also, like, what we eat for, like, breakfast, lunch, and dinner as well, instead of not a lot of variations. We do stir-fry sometimes, but it's not, like, a main component of our meals. And then a lot of, like, grilled meats instead of, like, anything that's, like, oils.
And obviously you're celebrating pho this mm-hmm. month, but some other cuisines as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. We're highlighting different aspects. Vietnamese cuisine has so many different foods that people can celebrate. And I feel like pho is very trendy right now. So I'm hoping to push Hoosiers beyond just pho. So they have Vietnamese coffee, for instance. Most people don't know that Vietnam is the second largest producer of coffee beans. So we're going to be highlighting that with a local coffee shop. We're going to be making spring rolls with Super Bowl pho up in Westfield and learning about their story. Trying out the street foods that make Vietnam popular, so banh mi sandwiches, and learning how that stemmed out of French colonization with the baguettes and just how their history really influenced the recipes. There's so many great dishes to try besides just pho.
Is this also a kind of soup that we're supposed to slurp when we eat?
I really like to slurp, and then we think that it's a compliment if you slurp. It makes the chef feel like it's that you're saying that they did well.
Slurping is definitely encouraged, Sharon, when it comes to eating your pho. And you can see all of the Yelp Indies Pho Brewery events by visiting its website at yelp.com, or they have a Facebook page, Yelp Indie, as well.
A way to warm your heart, warm somebody's heart near you.
And have fun slurping noodles.
Slurping noodles. All right. You know what? There are other fun things to do here to warm up in the winter. And I think that brings us to our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
Besides eat lovely soup.
Well, tonight, January 28th, last chance to hear the Texas Tenors. They're going to be at the Palladium where they're also honoring military veterans, both active and veterans and first responders. Tonight's performance is at 8 o'clock, and this is a brand new program from the Texas Tenors, and we know a lot of our PBS viewers have enjoyed them on WFYI 1 TV as well.
January 28th, tonight, Saturday night at 7:30, is Concierto and Tango. It is the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra's next offering, and it explores all kinds of rhythms and colors of Latin America and France as well, with interesting soloists, including the Encore Vocal Arts singers. So that's going on. See if you can still score a ticket at icomusic.org.
One of our small studio session featured artists, Gordon Bonham. He's always out and about, and he's going to be on Tuesday, January 31st, playing at the Slippery Noodle. So if you need a little blues music, you can head downtown for that at 7:30.
You know, if you like mysteries, you've probably read about or maybe seen various movie versions of The Black Dahlia, which is one of the most captivating murder mysteries of the 20th century. Well, Gregory Hancock Dance Theater has set this story to dance, and they're doing these concerts February 4th through the 19th, Saturdays at 7, Sundays at 3. And you can find out much more about that at GregoryHancockDanceTheater.org, The Black Dahlia in choreography.
We have a First Friday. The First Friday in February is coming up. And the Long Sharp Gallery at 50 West Washington, they're right inside the Conrad Hotel. They are having a brand new show of forms and shapes. It's with a variety of different local and national and international artists as well. Over at the Stutz, they are celebrating the color red with all of their artists in their exhibit, too. And then over at the Circle City Industrial Complex in the North Side Studios, Satch is moving from her upstairs studio to downstairs. Oh. She's a wonderful collective artist.
Is.
And Nancy Lee has some new jewelry in hers as well. And then the South Studios are going to be opening up for their first Friday, too, the Full Circle 9 Gallery. We're going to get to meet some of them in an upcoming episode of The Art of the Matter. But check them out, First Friday, this Friday night from 6 to 9 p.m.
At the Heron Galleries through February 18th, there is a major survey exhibition of Tom Sachs' paintings showcasing his ongoing interest in combining mass-produced pop cultural icons with a handmade aesthetic. It's called Radiant City Paintings 2000 to 2016, and again, it goes on through February 18th at the Heron Galleries.
And also, both First Friday and other days of the week, you can visit Amoca at Cityway, the Museum of Contemporary Art. They're out of the Fountain Square area, just downtown now. Sarah Hobbs' photographs are installed right there now. You can go get your up-close and personal look at them through June the 24th.
This weekend is the last call for the Nature of Art Painted Parks, which is on display at the historic Brown County Art Gallery. This is works by Rick Wilson, who spent more than 2 years painting in plein air in all of our state's parks and some of our state recreational areas as well. And he did that through all the different seasons. So go down and check that out before it closes this weekend.
And if you need something else to do to stay busy, you can definitely go to the Indie Arts, Arts Council of Indianapolis Indie Arts Guide. It's indiearts.org/guide. Or we'll be back again next week, won't we, Sharon?
We will with our calendar we call.
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. The Center for the Performing Arts stages a series of monthly Saturday morning concerts for kids aged 1 to 7. They're called Peanut Butter and Jam Sessions, and our own Arts with Kids reporter Jill Sheridan recently took her young daughter and son to try one out.
Veronica asks where we are after parking in the large garage in Carmel's city center.
We're at the Center for Performing Arts.
Max immediately has fun with the building's acoustics.
The Echo Max?
The Center for Performing Arts includes two smaller theater spaces and the Grand Palladium. The domed European-style building seats 1,600 and is the jewel of Carmel's art scene. But communication manager Scott Hall says the center is more than just a state-of-the-art concert hall.
And so we really have a public mission that goes beyond just putting on great concerts. And that includes a lot of events that go on here at the center. also a lot of outreach events that we take to schools and other places throughout central Indiana.
Inside one of the smaller rooms off the main performance space at the Palladium, still large enough to hold dozens of children and just as many adults, this month's Peanut Butter and Jam series is going on.
The wheels on the bus go square and square, square and square, square and square. What is this, a mutiny?
This particular Saturday morning, Central Indiana children's singer, ventriloquist, and songwriter Mark Thomas and his puppet Max the Moose are the main attraction. Veronica jumps right in and takes a seat up front as Thomas warms up the crowd. The series is aimed at children between the ages of 2 to 7, so it's perfect for my little ones. Max takes a little time to get into it, but when the Moose comes out, he's definitely interested.
They're singing your song.
Especially one like Max. Oh, he can't even cook. He makes me chocolate snacks. You want to sing with me now? Max the Moose is a friend of mine.
Thomas says there's an art to writing songs for children.
Oh, man. You like think participation a lot because you really want to get kids involved physically, you know, with motions and if you can get them singing and making sounds and things like that.
Community Engagement Manager Julia Schildmeier-Highway says the series is meant to introduce the arts to children in an engaging way.
To personally connect with the arts in a way that our peanut butter and jam artists allow the kids to do, to get up, to be physical, to be part of it. And then they start to feel a sense of ownership that I can do this too. Not only can I come to a great performance and observe it, but I can also be part of it.
She says they try to use performers from the central Indiana area with a variety of musical genres. Schildmeier-Highway hopes it helps children gain an appreciation for the fun of the arts.
And it really, you know, helps you celebrate the human experience, I think. And so they then hopefully will continue to be a part of the arts, whether it's as a performer or as a patron of the arts. Both sides are crucial.
When the reviews are in, 4-year-old Harper isn't the only one who says Max the Moose was a highlight.
I like the moose.
Veronica especially likes the way he expresses his language arts.
When Max the Moose did his ABCs, it was ABC, wee!
Mark Thomas says at a time when many communities are cutting arts and music education, shows like his play an increasingly important role.
It helps children to learn so many things. Music is a great way to connect the brain to a lot of things that you wouldn't expect. Even mathematics is affected by music.
The Peanut Butter and Jam series runs once a month through May at the Center for the Performing Arts.
Thank you.
Jill Sheridan with Veronica and Max. The Center for the Performing Arts' next Peanut Butter and Jam concert is Saturday, February 25th at 10:30, and it features music of the British Isles. Bridge is the name of an innovative art project that will produce digital works made of light and controlled by input from hospital patients. The project is the brainchild of Greg Hall, a Heron School of Art and Design sculpture professor, in collaboration with Assistant Professor Juliet King, director of Heron's Graduate Art Therapy Program, and Dr. Robert Pascuzzi, chair of the Department of Neurology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. The project is one of two to receive the inaugural $100,000 Transformational Impact Fellowship from the Arts Council of Indianapolis. I invited the team in to tell us about this experiment at the intersection of art, medicine, and humanity. Greg, I'm going to start with you. First of all, can you just outline your project and tell me how you met your colleagues here?
Sure. The project really stemmed from a fairly simple idea. It's the realization that as patients enter the hospital, they have to give over a certain degree of self-control. And so the thought was if there's a way to return some control to the patients, that would be a really positive thing for their experience and as a way to maybe combat depression and anxiety. So I started thinking about my lack of experience working with patients, and that brought me to Juliet. Juliet and I both work at the Heron School of Art and Design. I teach sculpture there, and Juliet's the director of the graduate art therapy program. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to her about actually engaging with patients. I thought it would be important to work with somebody who had experience working with patients.
So my first thought was what a great idea it was and how we do not have a ton of interventions in the profession of art therapy that afford people that have limited mobility a chance to express themselves. And so we work an awful lot with people that have both psychiatric and medical challenges. But when it comes to people that have difficulty with movement, whether their hands, their feet, their arms, that this would really be an effective intervention for people with those challenges. And so I automatically thought about the work that I'm doing over at the Neuroscience Center with the Department of Neurology and my boss, Dr. Pascuzzi, who specializes in patients that have Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, Greg, let's bring this over to Dr. Pascuzzi and we can talk a little bit about how this kind of intervention might be useful for that population.
Well, certainly there's a huge need for finding ways to help patients, whether they're acutely sick in the hospital or if they have a chronic problem at home, for reasons that Greg mentioned. They lose their identity, their autonomy, their independence. They question why things are the way they are. And we, in medicine, we do a lot to take care of patients, but I'm not sure we uniformly are thorough about exploring what their concerns and worries and fears are and how to get them into a better space. And then the Lou Gehrig's disease patients have a slow, progressive, creeping paralysis, and oftentimes their ability not just to move but to speak is affected and to express themselves. So this is a particularly vulnerable group of patients who are faced with big challenges about why things are happening and what they're losing and what it all means. And while we have many tools and techniques to treat symptoms of that condition, there's a great need to try to help explore their psychological, emotional, existential issues and concerns. So this makes a lot of sense to have a way to allow patients to express themselves differently and use that as a framework for exploring how to get them in a better place.
Mm-hmm. Is the Greg, when you first had this thought, was it because somebody you knew had gone into the hospital, or is it a more a big picture concept?
Yeah, level? I think it was lots of things that contributed to it. Some personal experience. I had an opportunity to develop a proposal for a medical institution, and part of the research just let me know that I was introduced to those ideas and to ideas like the impact that nature and art both have on the healing experience of patients in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Just saw opportunities where artists could intersect with that population and have a positive contribution.
How far are you into this project at this point? Have you had some trial and error, done some experiments with patients saying, what do you think about this? How does this, does this feel right? Or have you gotten some feedback?
We have. We're at sort of a really interesting juncture in the process. We're about a year into this 2-year fellowship, and we've just gotten initial approval from the IRB. It's the Institutional Review Board, which evaluates the project, and we can talk more about that. But over the course of the last year, we've been developing these interfaces. These are little sensors and things that can collect data, physiological data, and we're using those sensors to generate these images. So we've been working on those interfaces. We've been working on the programs that would make these visual images that will be projected on the spaces these patients will be in. So it's been a really steadily busy year. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe the biggest – actually, I'm really excited where we are right now with the IRB process. We're actually able to now begin working with patients. And so we've had some patient interaction but not directly with this project. And now that we have the approval, we'll be able to move that forward.
So forgive me because I won't have the right medical vocabulary to ask this question, but would part of the goal be – I'm a person dealing with a challenge. I can interact with this technology. Is there a, for want of a better term, kind of a biofeedback aspect to this?
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Biofeedback is being translated into visual imagery rather than being numbers or graphs and charts. These are dynamic images that are changing simultaneously to changes that the patient participant is experiencing. Mm-hmm.
If I could add to that, I think that the biofeedback or neurofeedback aspect to it, in that we are picking up physiological data, including brain waves and eye blink and skin temperature, is a component of this. But another big part of the past year has been spending time in the clinic, meeting the patients, observing the work that Dr. Pascuzzi does, and really talking to them and their families about the kinds of interventions that might be helpful. So oftentimes medical and treatment teams and researchers think, okay, well, this is going to be a really great idea, and we kind of miss the boat with actually connecting with the people that are having the challenges.
Sure.
And so we've made that very much a priority of this project to find out, well, what kinds of things would people want to work on? And oftentimes, as usual, those are issues of relational nature. And so how do we communicate with our loved ones? How do we help our loved ones and people that are taking care of us bear some of the burden? A lot of times that people that are enduring these kinds of experiences feel worse for the people around them than they do themselves, right? And so a lot of times we need to explore those kinds of issues, and then also of more existential nature, and look at, well, how does my limited or decreasing functioning, how is that going to impact, and how does it impact my emotional state and my perspective of things? And so we've spent a lot of time in the clinic gathering this kind of information so that we're more prepared when we actually begin working with people to know the kinds of questions to ask and the imagery that's created. How do we use that to inform the conversation?
And then it strikes me that you have a really remarkable opportunity dealing with people who have a very, very slow but steady progression of loss of ability to communicate, to control. And if there's a way to take this technology and this feedback down that road, is that something you, and I realize funding is not unlimited at this point, but is that something you're exploring?
Yes. I think there are many possible great outcomes from this sort of application of trying to get information that's generated by patients that can help them express themselves when they're in a difficult situation.
Greg Hull, Heron School of Art and Design Sculpture Professor, Juliet King, Director of Heron's Graduate Art Therapy Program, and Dr. Robert Pascuzzi, Chair of the Department of Neurology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Their collaborative project called Bridge will provide a way for patients, including those with limited mobility because of neurological conditions such as ALS and Parkinson's disease, to interact with and generate imagery that they can experience and change in real time, as well as potentially share with a larger audience. The team was one of two winners of the inaugural $100,000 Transformational Impact Fellowship from the Arts Council of Indianapolis. New Wave Collective got its big break at a hi-fi event in 2013, and they've just gotten better since then. Kyle Long invited Fresco, that's Cortland Tunstall, in to talk five songs this week.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Cortland Tunstall, better known as Fresco, of the Indianapolis hip-hop crew New Wave Collective. Cortland, thank you for being here.
Oh, no problem, man, no problem.
You have a new EP out titled Motion Sickness. Mm-hmm. Folks can go to newwavecollective.bandcamp.com to hear that project.
Please.
Yeah, please, check it out. And you're going to share five songs with us today.
Yeah.
They have nothing to do with that EP, but...
No.
What do you have up first for us?
Okay, my first record would be Is That Enough by Marvin Gaye.
Oh, I was a dream from the start, fooling around with my mind.
That record is just, I don't know, it's something about the record, man. It's just the aura of it. I think, like, when it comes in, it's like... It had the same sample that's used on Sippin' on Some Scissor by 3-6 Mafia is the same sample that comes in the beginning, but you can hear like the actual live instruments. And then there's this breakdown at the end where it's like, I need to smoke. Wait a minute. And then the like all the instruments come out. Oh, man, you gotta play it. Like it's amazing.
I need to smoke. Wait a minute.
Number two, I say right now number two is probably Redbone, Childish Gambino. That's like another soul record, basically, but just like a modern day soul. Everything about that record is just dope. I've never really been like a huge Childish Gambino fan, so this was the first project that I, and a lot of people don't feel that way, but I actually like the project a lot. Number three right now is Problems. It's by an artist named Slack. His name is spelled 6 like, you know, the number six, L-A-C-K. That record is just dope. It's like basically about his relationship issues and stuff. It talks from both perspectives, but it does it in a new way, and so I really like that record. Crazy, I made her that way. Every time I see her out, I see the hate in her face. Why you do that? Tell her you love her when next week you just want your space. Why you do that? Tell her you want her, but next week you do your own thing. Why you do that? Fourth right now is Frank Ocean, Nights. I think the lyricism in it, definitely the writing in it. It's just, I don't know, it's just the way he does it. It's dope. The Reverend, preacher self-made millionaire status. When we could only eat at Shoney's on occasion. After Trina hit, I had to transfer campus. Your apartment I didn't use since where I waited. Staying with you when I didn't.
Fifth and final song with Cortland Tunstall of the New Wave Collective
is Jewels by Allen Iverson. No, I'm just playing.
That would be hilarious.
Nah. My fifth record is Kanye West, Late. I feel like that's just like my life, you know, like late to everything. But he puts like a cool spin on it, and the beat is incredible. It was a bonus track, so you didn't really know it was coming. So that was really dope about it.
I'll be late for that, baby, I wait for that. If you had a taste of that, you probably pay for that. I'm coming in when I feel like to turn this moth up only if it feels right. I'll be late for that.
And my guest has been Cortland Tunstall, better known as Fresco, of the New Wave Collective hip-hop crew. And Cortland, give folks like a quick sketch of what you guys are all about, New Wave Collective.
We are about making really dope hip-hop music that is not necessarily boxed into hip-hop music. And we talk about everything. We like to party, but we also like to sit down and have coffee. So we're just human beings, and we're making good music. You can check us out, newwavecollective.bandcamp.com. You can check us out on Twitter, Nuwo, N-U-W-O, 317. Facebook, New Wave Collective, once again. If you're just looking for me, check me out, soundcloud.com/HardwoodFresco. Hardwood Fresco. Thank you.
You guys are definitely making some of the freshest sounding music in the Indianapolis scene, so appreciate you sharing the music with us, man.
I appreciate it.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for spending some time with The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer and Jill Sheridan. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll meet some of the artists behind Central Library's Meet the Artist exhibition and visit a school where you can learn to DJ. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.